Jesus, I would like to come in and read the Word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what is this to you?
We'll do it live. We'll do it live. Fuck it. Do it live. I'll write it and we'll do it live. This thing sucks.
Good morning.
Morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schmid is brilliant and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. Tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Into the dustbin of history. For the next 3 weeks, probably, we are going to listen to three consecutive Gene Shepherd programs from his return from his vacation in Nigeria. He did five of them, but unfortunately the first two have not survived. So from Wednesday, March 21st, 1962, here's Trip to Nigeria, Part 3, Gene Shepherd, Lost Programs from the Gary Hines Collection. Here in the dustbin of history, WBAI, New York.
Thank you. Very good. You know, this is like opening up the legendary Pandora box. Apparently there is an insatiable desire on the part of a large number of people to know something about Africa. I have literally been deluged with mail, and when I say that, I mean like well over seven letters. No, all jesting aside, though, I am knee-deep in inquiries about Africa, one kind or another, in particular on the West Coast. You know, most people, when they think of Africa, they're thinking of the East Coast of Africa, the Sudan, possibly Kenya. But generally speaking, the Great Plains area, which is well over on the eastern seaboard area of Africa, and this is the great game preserves around Nairobi and so on. And the part of Africa that hardly anyone knows anything about is the West Coast, which is a very different situation. And this is the area of what the country called the Gold Coast. There is such a country, you know, Togoland, Ghana, of course, Nigeria, and the whole big bend of Africa that bends down over the Bay of Guinea and hangs down right over on and above the equator. Now this part of Africa isn't known too well because it isn't travelogsville. People don't go there on the long safari. They don't go there because, first of all, it's not as easy to get to. It's a much more difficult part of Africa to be part of. To integrate yourself into, it's just well off what they call the beaten track. And you know, one of the things that I noticed about these small countries, it's kind of funny in a way, it's sad in another way, and in another way, it's perhaps indicative of a lot of things that are wrong with the whole world that we live in today. And that is that the whole problem of status has become a very important thing in the little countries. The little recently liberated or the recently made independent countries like Ghana and people like Nigeria. And, of course, they are tremendously involved in trying to establish a separate identity above and beyond and apart and around from the old identity that they used to have, which is a colonial status. Now, what are some of the things that a nation today does to obtain status? This is where the sadness comes in. What does a man do today who immediately makes money, who has never made money before? Well, one of the first things he does is go out and buy a big car. I'm just talking about men as opposed to nations. He'll buy a big car, or he'll go out and buy himself a big, wild, badly designed home, even if he has no need for it. He's looking for status, and most people, when they look for status, look for it in the physical sense. They will buy things that can be shown to other people. Well, one of the great status symbols among the little nations today is the airline. Every little country wants to have its own airline, even if it's economically unfeasible. Totally ridiculous. Now I don't know, yeah, even if they only have one airplane and they have one mechanic, they have one pilot who only works every other day, they have three people to take tickets. This is what they've got to have. They've got to have an airline because, you see, for all their time, all the time before, they always see the great big plane come in and it'll say BOAC, British Overseas Airways, you know, or Air France comes in. And somehow that is a symbol of civilization. It's a symbol of the big country who's really made it. Now, I don't know whether you know anything about the economics of airlines, but it's difficult for a solvent country to support a solvent airline. In other words, you take a country like Germany. Germany certainly is one of the most solvent countries in Europe today. But it's very difficult for them to sustain their airlines, which is one of the most successful airlines in the world, Lufthansa. They lose money in a lot of ways, and it's a real struggle. Well, you can imagine how a little country like Nigeria, who doesn't really have anything in the way of physical property yet, how they can sustain an airline, or why they even need an airline, is an important or interesting question. But all the newspapers when I arrived in Nigeria were all full of the fact that Nigeria Airlines has just bought a whole fleet of jets, the big ones, you know, the big 707. Oh, yeah, no, they don't want the little DC-3s or the C-47s They don't want the DC-6s. They want a jet. The idea of a jet somehow is very important. It's a status symbol. The idea of having a big four-engine jet. Well, now this requires a really involved system of maintenance. It requires a lot more. It ain't the original purchase. It's the upkeep with a thing like that. Well, so they have this big story in the paper about how they're making big strides forward now. They're going to have these jets, and Nigeria Airlines is going to enter international, by the way. That's another interesting thing. They don't want the airlines, which are purely local. That's fine. I can understand the need for this, you know, to fly from Ibadan to Kano, or from Kano to Jos, or from Jos to Lagos. The internal airlines is very important in a place like Africa. But the international airline is another story. But this is what they want. They want their airline to fly into London. They want their airline, they want their plane to land in Paris. They want their airline to come down into New York. That is the final one, to have your plane land every day at New York. Now, whether or not it's got anybody on it, whether or not that's not important. See, it's this thing. Well, they had large numbers of lineage in the papers about how they were buying these jets, but they had to go to India to get the technicians to operate them. They had just hired an Indian to run the whole airlines, and this was a well-known airline executive. And then there was an editorial in the paper a couple of days ago lashing out against this. Of course, this is nationalistic again. Why do we have to hire an Indian? Why don't we hire a local native Nigerian to run this thing? Well, of course, the answer is very simple. None of them had ever run an airlines before, you know, but that never seemed to enter the idea of what they were discussing about. So, yeah, and so you run into these poor, sad things that are amusing. So every one of these little countries is preparing to have an airlines. And they're wildly borrowing money from all over the place to buy themselves some jets. Now, incidentally, if you're listening to me on FM, stand back from the radio there, because some of the better FM sets, colds are contagious through FM. The very high fidelity FM sets, you can get a cold very, very easily. And in fact, in some ways, even easier than if you were here in person. So stand back. And the cold that I have is a result of climate change. You know, speaking of climate, one of the things that people write to me about now is the idea that they like hot weather. You know, they say, well, gee, I just like hot weather. It sounds wonderful. Well, the kind of heat that is in the interior of a place like Nigeria is not the kind of heat, any sort of heat that you have ever come into contact with. Heat there is an organic element in its own right. It's like aluminum or bismuth. And you can be cold and great chunks of heat are falling off of your clothes. You know? That's the truth. It's just like water, you know? You can be ice cold, but the heat is falling off you. You can pull it off in chunks, you know? It's a thing, and survival in some places is a major operation. I remember one incident. I had gone into the interior and I was crossing over near a river, and there was a little island out on the river, and there was a man who was going to take me out on the island there, a native. And by the way, that was one of the greatest afternoons I've ever spent in my life with this guy and his wife. His wife sort of looked like, in a sense, almost looked like Jigs. And she was wearing this wild robe. They were magnificent robes and beautiful clothing of one kind or another. Everybody is very uninhibited. You know, it's a funny thing to sit in a cab, and you're riding through a town in a cab, and the guy's sitting up in front, and all the cabs are little cabs, like Hillmans. They use Hillmans, they use Opals for cabs, and they're the best cabs for this place because the roads are narrow, traffic is fanatically wild. I mean, you couldn't imagine such wild traffic in the towns. Everything. People with bananas on their heads, bicycles, guys rowing things down the street, other guys. And it's all in a giant stream that just goes. And the pedestrian has absolutely no rights. No rights whatsoever there. Because, you see, riding a thing gives you status. If you're driving something or riding in something, your status is infinitely higher than the guy who's walking. So if you run over a guy, well, that's his own problem. Oh yeah, the week I was there, and I know a lot of people are going to object. A lot of Nigerian nationalist types are going to object. I happen to know this is true because I was talking to one of the police sergeants there, that they had killed on the Ibadan Road in 1 week. 7 guys were killed who were just walking along the road with bananas on their heads, and not one guy who hit somebody stopped. Pow! That's all. They just keep right on going, you know, like running over a rabbit. Speaking of rabbits, it's WORAM with FM New York. And the thing about this afternoon, I got out there and I was going across a little river. Well, it was pretty wide actually. It was about half a mile wide, and they have beautiful dugout canoes that are the most graceful boats. And he was going to pull me across this river. Well, I got across the river, and everything was okay. And I got on the island, and on the other side of the island, there was a beach, which I was going to. I wanted to see this. It was you can't imagine. If you can imagine Jones Beach stretching from here to eternity with brilliant white, crystal white sand, and the waves rolling in from the Atlantic, just rolling in steadily, and these huge palm trees just hanging out over that sand, just laying down over the sand, just magnificent beach, and dotted here and there along the beach are little thatched huts, little places where people live among the pigs and stuff, and very happy, wildly happy people, just, and the most open do anything type, you know, the minute you stop, you know, what do you want? So, but the interesting thing about nobody on the beach but you, just this beautiful beach. Oh, incidentally, something about the beaches should be said. Some of the greatest sharks in the world live offshore, off of Western Africa. I mean, sharks that are real sharks. I mean, these are the real thing, you know, the kind that take in a whole boat. And they just crunch the wood and oil down, and they're out. They don't bother the swimmers, but they do have barracuda. The thing though that they do have that is much more frightening than either the barracuda or the shark. They have probably the greatest undertow in the world, that people are constantly being swept out to sea, and there were 6 of them who were drowned in one day at one beach just because of the under. And there's nothing you can do. You're about 3 feet in the water, and, you know, you just walk right into the water a little bit, you know. It's just like wading at Jones Beach, and all of a sudden it was as if something, 2 giant hands grabbed you by the ankles and just, boom, just pulled you right out under the water and 150 feet out under, and that's it. And nobody sees you again. This is the kind of undertow they have, so it isn't really very safe to bathe. You just sunbeach, you sunbathe out there, but oh boy, the sunbathing. That sun hangs down there, and it's made out of pure molten lava. And oh, let me tell you. So I'm walking across this island. Now we're getting to the point. It's a very funny moment. I'm walking across the island by myself, and this is right out of an Osa and Martin Johnson movie. It's a sort of a little savanna, this island, and flat territory. And along the path that I was walking, there were bunches of little Nigerian cattle, or African cattle. Now, if you can imagine a cow, a regular Jersey cow, a regular or a Guernsey, regular cow, about half size, comes up to about your knee. This is the way they are. Beautiful little cattle, just perfectly formed cows, but they're only about knee high. Huh? How come? That's just the way they are there. I don't know how come. I'm not an animal geneticist, but there they were. They're little half-sized cattle, and they're wild and skittish, but there they are. They're tiny cattle. Then there's another cattle. Oh, people are always getting mad, aren't they? What was that one mad about? Huh? Doesn't know, huh? Well, that's all right. I always figure that if I'm not getting people mad, I'm not saying the truth. Or at least I'm not skirting it. So anyway, there's another kind of cattle they have, which is a huge, enormous cattle that has a hump on the back and looks about twice the size of a Texas Longhorn. And they have horns that have a wingspread of about 5 feet. Enormous horns. You never saw such cattle. 2 types of cattle, distinct types. Well, I'm walking through this little savanna, and the sun is coming down. It's really rocking down, and there isn't a breath of air stirring. The temperature was about probably 105, and the humidity was about 95%. And I'm walking along, and it suddenly hit me. I'm sort of bowed down. I'm bowed down, and I'm walking as though I was walking like a snail, just like a snail. And I was just going along there, and it was like sort of swimming underwater, and this heat was just banging down on top of my head, and I'm kind of just walking. And it hit me my consciousness that says, I'm going like a snail here. Just like a snail. Well, I went out, I fooled around the beach a little bit, and then I came back, and this guy was waiting for me, and his wife. And his wife, in the meantime, a couple of Englishmen had shown up, and they were sitting on a rock, waiting to get back across the water, back to the mainland there. And so we're sitting there waiting for him to pull his boat back, and his wife is there, and she's eating coconut. You know, it's interesting to get into the inland and find that people are really living and eating the way you think they live and eat in Africa. Pieces of coconut, you know, big chunks of coconut, and she's giving me the coconut there. And also bananas. I was buying bananas in the village, they're little green bananas, but they're very sweet. Extremely sweet, and as soon as they get ripe, they're much sweeter than any banana that we ever have here, a different kind of banana. And they live on bananas. Great numbers of bananas are consumed there. And they grow everywhere, you know. They grow wild. So does the coconut grow wild, and the people live off this. So she's standing there in a robe, and suddenly she says, you me brother. You brother. I said, what? She says, you, brother. And then there was this Englishman sitting off to one side on a rock, and he was an older guy. And she pointed to him and says, he, father, he, me, father. And she was having this great time pointing out that I was her age, and this guy over here was old enough to be her father. And then there was another guy came along, and he was like her son. And she was just having a big uproarious time about this, and we were talking and laughing, and it's this kind of very simple, basic human contact that you have that you just never have anywhere else in the world. One of the things that I was grateful about, and one of the reasons why I wanted to go to Nigeria, is because I have a feeling that within the next 15 to 20 years, man in his, let's say, his original state, his unsullied state, will disappear from the face of the earth. That man in his, let's say, the pure man will disappear. I suppose this doctrine is related to the noble savage doctrine, but nevertheless, I feel that there will be a time in almost all of our lives where there will no longer ever be any place on the face of the globe, a place where you can see man living in nature, really part of nature rather than on top of nature or controlling nature, and in short, what we call civilized. As a matter of fact, I had grave misgivings. You know, people like Melville, people like Conrad, there have been hundreds of writers over the past 300 years who have talked about contact with the so-called simple peoples. And one thing they do come away with is the deep, almost the all-pervasive feeling that the things we have lost by the great machine civilizations that we have built up are irretrievable, and also the things which these people have are so rare and so precious that you could not describe these things unless, well, the only way to describe them, of course, there's no description of them. You have to experience it. Again, this is one of those things like taste. How can you describe how chocolate tastes? Or how can I describe to you how a fine brandy tastes? You have to experience it. It is a pure emotional and or physical experience. And this is what I found to be true in meeting and mingling with the people I found out there. It was just an experience that I just wouldn't give up. Now, you know, it's interesting, though, if you read the newspapers. Now, you have two different types of population, really widely different population in a place like Nigeria or Ghana. You have the rural people who are really rural. I mean, these people, many of them are living the way their ancestors did 2,000, 3,000 years ago. And I mean, actually, all they have is a calabash. They live, the children are never wear clothing until maybe they're 8, 9, 10 years old. They live in a genuine state of raw nature. And their involvement with one another has to be seen to be believed. I mean a true involvement. It's a kind of family involvement which must be the way people think togetherness is, only it isn't. You know what I mean? In our electronic civilization. I stood above a little family. I happened to be in an excellent position, a kind of a strategic position, looking down on a little family for about 2 hours. And the mother was weaving mats. She had, apparently it was her sister there. And these two women were weaving mats and they were singing. And there were, must have been 10 kids running around, little kids ranging all the way from probably a year old, one of them was just beginning to walk, to, oh, probably 8 or 9 years old. Now, it must have been two families together. And these kids were playing. You know, they don't play with toys the way we do in our civilization. The kids don't have toys. Like, they don't need toys. They play with things, right, you know, they'll play with a stick or a ball or a rock or a calabash or something, just little things. You see them, because I watched the children specifically all over the country, everywhere I went, and they crawl. They were just crawling all over one another and yelling and hollering and having this deeply involved time. And they break apart, and then one would lie down and sleep, and then another one would get up and they run around, and it was just going on. And the women were weaving the mats and singing, and there was a sense there of a kind of living that is opposed. Now, again, this has to be explained. I am not a noble savageite, but it was a sense of living organically. Do you know what I mean by organically? Being part of the environment in which you find yourself. It's like lying on the grass when you're 10 years old and looking down into the dirt, and you see all these little bugs, you know, and the sun is coming down. And a kid, you know, can become part of the landscape far more than any adult in Western civilization. He really does, you know. A kid is dug into the earth sometimes when he's 9 or 10. Now, if you can imagine living your whole life like that, where the sun is part of your world, the earth is part of your world, and all the people around you are as much part of you as your own foot. Well, this is the kind of existence you find in these tiny villages. These people live with one another and off one another, but it's a real experience too. And it's not the sort of thing, though. Again, people keep writing and say, "What about a tourist going there?" Well, I don't know. You see, I go more as a reporter. I go as a person who is trying to experience things, and I move all day long, and everywhere I go, I do things that I don't think most tourists would do, you know? In other words, I have a mission there, not just to visit, but to experience. And one of the things that I found is that everybody, no matter where you go, you run into the common denominator. For example, are you aware that guys are bugged by chicks in Nigeria, just like guys are bugged by chicks on Bleecker Street? And they're just like they're bugged by chicks up in Westport. Well, I'm sitting there one Sunday, and I'm reading the paper. I picked up the Post, which is a Nigerian paper, and it's a tabloid-sized paper. And on the outside of the paper here, they have this big article. It says, Inside, Angels of Doom, see page 13. It says, Angels of Doom. You know, for crying out loud, I'm eating breakfast. And one of the things that you always eat for breakfast in Africa, or at least most of the Europeans did there, they ate pawpaw. Sliced pawpaw, put a little sugar on it, you know, and you're in business. And about the only thing that I had there that could have been really called native food was pawpaw, a great deal of fruit of one kind or another. And also there was an antelope that I had. I had some antelope meat at one point, which I had there in a restaurant in Ibadan. How would you like to go into a restaurant and the centerpiece of the restaurant? It's this beautiful restaurant, and they had a little centerpiece. It was a little vase in the middle of it. And the vase contains 6 beautifully formed, magnificent, miniature African orchids. Beautiful orchids. And this is just the center thing on the table. Oh, now here's the piece I wanted to read to you. get the High Life music up there. I'm going to play some more of this music for you because everybody has been writing about this. You cannot buy this music, as far as I know, here in the States. This has all been recorded in Nigeria and is sold in Nigeria, of course, and throughout all the area of West Africa. Now, I'll have to point out something, that almost all the countries have their own kind of music. This is the popular music of Nigeria. This is not tribal music, but it is all based on various tribal pieces of music of one kind or another. Now, the one I'm going to play for you here is a song about a four-wheel cart. A four-wheel cart of the kind that is used in a certain area of Nigeria. Yeah, this is a certain area of Nigeria, and this is about a cart. And this is a typical high life group of Nigeria. And the name of it is Omalanke, which is the name of the cart. And it's just a piece of music simply about the cart. And is usually, when it is sung, in its native form, is usually sung when guys are pushing these carts around. It's a four-wheel cart. This is a high life group record. And all night long, this stuff comes out of doorways, played at 14 dB above ground level. You never heard such distortion in your life. Everything is done bigger than life there.
Yes. Where are you going, laddie? I'm going to the city with this money, to make my fortune there. Want to make your fortune, then you must save for a rainy day.
If you want, oh, you're playing the wrong one.
Then you must save.
You're playing rainy day. That's all right. Get me the one on the cart. That's the last cut on side one. Just put it there. Omalanke. This is Rainy Day. Save for a Rainy Day. That's Sammy Akpabat and his all-stars. Now, before we go any further, it's just cut side one. It's on the same side, Ed. Where are you going there? It's on side one, the last cut. Omalanke. Now, this stuff goes right with it, because one of the things that's happening throughout all of Lagos is there has been a great growth of a kind of nightlife that you couldn't possibly imagine unless you've actually been there. Some of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in this side of a fantasy are in and about the nightlife of Lagos. I went to this place called the Lido. Everyone knows about it. So Lido is the place in Nigeria. It's open air. It's in Lagos, and it's open air, and it's teeming, just literally teeming with life. And they have all these tables just sitting up there out in the air, and everybody is drinking Nigerian beer, and there's a dance floor. And up on in the back in the dance floor, there's a guy, by the way, the day I was there, there was this high life band, and obviously Louis Armstrong had deeply influenced the guy who was playing the horn and who was the leader of this thing. And he even had a TV suit on. You know what I mean by a TV suit? The kind of suit that you see guys like George Goldblum that wear, those shiny suits. All the Boy Circuit comics wear when they appear on Ed Sullivan. Those shiny suits, you know, those Dacron suits. Well, he had this shiny suit, and he was blowing the daylights out of his horn, you see. And he has this big handkerchief, and obviously he's playing Louis to the hilt. But not quite making it. There was something in there, what he was blowing, that wasn't Louis. I mean, it was pure Nigerian. I could hear it. And on the other hand, you could hear that he was striving for something that he didn't normally feel. But I was sitting there, and I was just soaking all this in. And these beautiful girls, dressed in Western dress, dressed in native dress, dressed in all kinds of dress. Everybody. And there were two people particularly dancing. It was a beautiful girl. They get this rapt look on her face. She's a beautiful, beautiful girl, and she's wearing a Western dress, sort of like an evening dress, but not quite a short, what would be called sort of an afternoon cocktail party type dress here, you know. And she's dancing, and she's tall, and she's maybe 5'7", and she's, everything is in the right place, you know, in exactly the right proportions. And she's moving, and the band is playing there. And she's dancing with this guy who must, and they're dancing far apart. This is not the twist, by the way. It's a certain kind of dance which is done with the high life music. And she's dancing with this guy who must have been 7 feet tall. 7 feet tall, and he was the most beautiful color. He was like he was carved out of pure ebony. Magnificent figure. And he was wearing long white robes. These robes went right down to the floor, and he's just moving back there. And both of them are moving back and forth, and the light is flickering. Oh, boy. I'm sitting right there in the middle of all this, you know, breaking out in the cold sweat. Oh, high life. That's the song of the cart. Now hold it. I'll give you the cue there. Just cut her down there. Now, I'll read you the piece now from the Post, and you'll know that the guys are getting bugged all over the world. I read it to you word for word. The sun is high in the sky. The temperature is 100 degrees and more. The day is not a holiday. Most men and women are at work in the offices and workshops or doing their day's share of legitimate business in the shops and markets. But for her, today and every day is a holiday. In defiance of the heat, in defiance of all the laws of nature, she's draped completely in beautiful woolen material. Her skull is bare except for a pair of dainty earrings and equally dainty sunglasses. On her left wrist, she wears 6 or so beaded bracelets, and on her right, a man's wristwatch. There is a determined spring in her step as she walks out of the joint and into the street where she hails a taxi. 10 chances to none, she's going to the crowded department stores on the marina. Lagos. That's the Fifth Avenue of Lagos. And she's got no shopping to do unless it's the type of shopping which she has been doing over the years. Like the class of Lagos girls, which she typifies, she is young, smart, good-looking. But in many ways, she's as good and valuable as a used postage stamp. She may have been married or single. She may even now be married. But that doesn't matter. She is an angel of destruction. And she has a job of work to do. She has sworn to do the job thoroughly well. Pity her victims. Bachelors or married men doing overtime on extramural duties. Many young men get caught in the net of deceitful appearances. Some have escaped with just the scathing remembrance of the encounter. Others have graduated through the jailhouse and have started on a lifelong career of crime because of her. Others have proved too soft to survive the shock of their encounter and have died mysterious, untimely deaths. Oh no, the class of girls about which I am talking about are not women of the street. Oh no. To say that they're crooks is to use a term which packs in too much and yet is hardly to the point. To say that they are dupes is an understatement. Fundamentally, they are pleasure-seeking, fun-loving people. Only with them, it's other people who have to pay for their pleasure, and their fun is derived from seeing people deceived into believing that life consists mainly in living in a fool's paradise. When they're tired of a particular line of enjoyment, they affect the change in a big way. This they frequently do by shedding off no longer useful boyfriends each time a new and more prosperous client shows up. These girls have no manner of work. They're always to be found walking the popular commercial streets, calling on fake brothers or cousins. They expect to be picked up, given a meal, taken out for drinks, and generally given a good time. This is the prelude to the negotiations which follow, negotiations in which terms are vaguely stated and accepted. Or, this is scarcely ever done, rejected. If a bargain is struck, then the affair begins. Shortly afterward, the victim is introduced to the group at the joint. He gets to know the members, ranging from confirmed permanent spinsters to casual married prospectors. Their ages, from 16 and under to well over 40. At all sessions, which last Every day from morning till the morning of the next day, drinks flow, boyfriends and girlfriends stroll in and out. There's nothing that stops. There's music all the time. And no type of dance is too lurid for the exponents to indulge themselves in. Occasionally a schoolgirl comes to the joint, brought there by another female member. If all goes well, a partner is found for her, and she is quickly initiated into the society. Even among this group, there is a subdivision. There are the sticking permanents, who take to a boyfriend at a time. And with them, fun also is fundamental. And gaiety is part and parcel of every moment of life. But the method of approach is slightly different. Not much of demands. They're so nice, so sacrificial, so pliant, so willing to please their man. When they've made sure of their hold on their man, the girls start to put on the squeeze. Now the man must pay for those lavish meals given and had at the joint, those drinks he didn't immediately pay for, those lazy, pleasurable moments that he had alone with his queen of hearts. That is the beginning of the end. But it could be just a danger signal, or it could be just another episode in the story of his conquest. For most, it would seem uncharitable, even wicked, to walk out. So they stay on. They start paying back. She makes her first big demand. She asks for one of those expensive materials to be found inside a glass front showcase in a corner of the lounge at the joint. Since payment is not immediate, because he has given all these articles on trust after signing the usual IOU, he doesn't quite feel the drain. Come month end and payday, he finds that two-thirds of his paycheck is gone. And that's just the beginning. There remains the usual round to be done. From then to the end of the month, he works. What next? Well, too proud and considerate to call it off, he must find ways to keep up. After all, aren't there other men there? They're doing it. What about that junior sales clerk who's to be found there every night, as happy as ever? How about the rest? He wasn't alone. And so he goes on and on and on and on until he finds himself thick in debt. Or he decides he's brave enough to start on a career of forgery or fraud to pay for his IOUs. Ultimately, he works his way up to the dock and the judgment. And the girls are there to see him off to jail, of course. When she's washing him off her hair, she's ready to start work on another victim. For her, life is never static. Listen to this beautiful passage. For her, life is never static. It's like an ocean, ceaselessly active. And she is in many ways herself like the ocean, sharing with that phenomenon of nature an unfathomable depth, a soothing calm, a tempestuous front, and above all, a ravenous appetite. Unlike the ocean, however, she is very discreet, discerning, and discriminating. She has a whole arsenal of assorted tricks, and she knows which one would be just the one for each new specimen. Let's call him partner. For example, she can smoke, and does smoke if the partner is a smoker. She refrains from smoking if the man doesn't fancy the habit. She paints her lips and fingernails if it's to the taste of the client. If not, she doesn't. Everything must be done to satisfy him. By the time he discovers that he's been taken for a ride, it's just too late. He's too far gone to recall his steps. At best, a guardian angel appears to salvage his remains. At worst, he's lost, and lost forever. Too bad, but he could have avoided it all. Caruba! You know, when I read this thing, the first thing I thought of was Saloon Society by Bill Manville in the Village Voice. And furthermore, the first thing I thought of when I was reading this is that this guy really is out. There is a personal vendetta he is having. That there is a specific chick he's directing this to. And this was from the Sunday paper in Lagos, and their papers are very, very entertaining and tell a great deal about the world that you're in. Do you want to hear a little more of the music now? We don't have too much time. I'll finish this record here. And this is the record that I was telling you about, which is just one of the just the one that you have up there. Just one of the typical highlights. To me, most of them sound the same. Even though they're all based on various tribal songs, they're sung in most cases in Igbo. Some of them are sung in Pidgin English. Others are sung in Yoruba, which is the native language spoken most often around the Lagos area. High life. Play just a little bit of one. The one group, this is, play for me, 1, 2, 3, 4, cut 4 on side 1. Olawa, Olawa, no, wait a minute, just a minute. Sawa, Julius Araba and his rhythm blues, cut 4, side 1. This is the group that has probably the most unique style of all of them, the most unusual. They have a jerky. Yeah, it's a good group. This is also sung in Yoruba. This is a specific style that comes from the area of Calabar. Isn't that a beautiful name for a city, Calabar? Oh. I saw the real thing. They don't do it like that. We're going to dance in it here in the studio. Trouble with us Westerners, we're all inhibited. Speaking of inhibitions, this is old Shep, and I'll be back tomorrow night with your favorite top tunes in High Life Rhythm. Mr. Ace, welcome to you in Yoruba, Hausa, and Igbo.
Sunday night at 9 o'clock, Elizabeth Taylor stars in the sensational...
Gene Shepherd, March 21st, 1962. Part 3 of Nigeria Trip and Part 4 will be heard on next week's edition of The Dustbin of History. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid, running over, even though we had time, but I'm going to play the outro anyway. Thanks for listening. Be back Sunday night, 8 to 10, with the Golden Age Radio, and right here next Wednesday midnight, in The Dustbin of History. Good night, gang.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal.